From WXXI News. This is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. Our connection today was made... Wait, what did I do? Did I remember to write that intro? Is my mic even on? Am I ready for that other thing I have to do later today? Yeah, I'm stressed. You're stressed. After this last year and a half, we are all stressed. And that is actually the topic of this hour. And yeah, I really do have an intro in front of me that I wrote. Jeremy Jameson is with us. He is an associate professor of psychology at the University of Rochester, where he is the principal investigator at the Social Stress Lab. And he says stress isn't always a bad thing. In fact, it can be a very good thing sometimes if you're ready to take your mind and body up a few notches. Jeremy, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me. It's wonderful being here.
Glad you could join us. You set a record for being one of the earliest guests to show up for Connections, which was another sort of stress that, oh, he's here. We're not ready for him yet. But that's okay. Your argument is that, in a nutshell, stress can cause what you call a challenge response. Explain this. Why is this a good thing?
Yeah, so stress can be growth promoting, and that's really the main takeaway. And I want to kind of back up a little bit to what stress actually is. And that, I think a lot of the problems we see in society that are tied to stress are rooted in this general idea that stress is always bad for me. We talk about lay theories, we talk about how people view their stress in their life. People say they're stressed when they're overwhelmed, when their demands are exceeding their ability to cope with those things. But when we mean stress, we just mean encountering any demand in your life. The demand, that's the stressor. Your stress response is how you respond to those demands. And so we can respond in lots of different ways. And so all of the models I work off of, they're called biopsychosocial models. A pretty long word that just means that our cognitive processes can have a direct effect on our biological processes. And a lot of the way we respond to stress is determined by us. We have agency in that in our brains. I mean, our stress systems don't have eyes or ears. It doesn't know what's going on in the world. We tell it. And so our body's sort of helping us to perform or helping us shy away from things that are dangers.
So we know what some of the obvious things are. Your heart starts pounding a little bit faster. Your blood pressure goes up. What are some of the less obvious physiological responses?
So those are the ones that we can notice. There's a term we call interoception, my ability to sort of perceive internal states in my body. Humans are generally pretty poor at this. And so if you ask somebody how fast is their heart beating, they can give you a general range, but they're not going to actually be able to perceive that. The ones we do notice are these sort of high sympathetic arousal responses. So that beating heart, that racing heart, the butterflies in my stomach, my sweaty palms, I can notice those things. Those things don't mean I'm in a challenge state or in a threat state. It's not a good stress and not a bad stress. It just means I'm activated. There's some demand that I'm presented with, my body sort of marshaling resources. And how we notice those is that we might then be stressed about being stressed. So we'll notice our heart rates elevate. We'll do all these things to try to calm down, to try to bring ourselves back to homeostasis. And sometimes it's very adaptive. Sometimes it's not so adaptive.
You've outlined this as being sort of a balance between demands and available resources. And I think a lot of us have really been pressed on that point over the last 18 months. So let's jump right into this big question of what the heck did the pandemic do to all of us? And how do we get ourselves back into a more normal state where stress becomes a more normal part of our lives and not what it's been perhaps for some of us?
Yeah, first off, the pandemic, it's created demands. Like, you're spot on in the sense that we're presented with this unexpected situation. And we had a complete change in our routines. Those things are going to create uncertainty. They create added demands. Maybe if you have children, for instance, you have to manage your workload, and you have to also educate your children and make sure they're safe in the environments that they're in. And so there, like, you have a boost of demands. And so do you have the resources to meet those things? I mean, think of this like a scale. So we're adding more weight to the demand side of the scale. Do I have sufficient weight on that resource side to take on those demands? If I do, I can push through that. I can thrive. I can sort of use that stress as fuel. If I perceive that I don't have the demands, that's when we feel overwhelmed. We feel threatened. And we go back to the evolutionary past. Our stress responses evolved. They were functional. They helped keep us alive. And so when we were threatened before, most of the stressors in the past were physical things. We could get injured. We could get hurt. And so your body doing things like centering blood in the core of your body, it's going to help you not bleed out if you ever got injured. Releasing cortisol, it's an anti-inflammatory. So you're expecting inflammation. And so all these changes that were really adaptive in a past setting, when you're talking about social stressors, so managing workloads, helping educate children, those responses we had that were functional before aren't so functional now. But we get to this challenge state, then we can sort of use that as fuel to help us achieve those needed ends.
Is there a difference between stresses that we've experienced before and ones that are completely brand new to us? Like I'm thinking about filling in this week for Evan, and I don't know how Evan does this, 50 weeks out of a year coming in here and doing two of these shows every day, 5 days a week. There's a lot that goes into it. And I'm not unstressed walking in here to do the show, but I've also done it before. And I know how it works, and I know exactly what those stresses are going to be, and hopefully what I need to do in order to meet them, and that I can depend on a phenomenal team around me to help me do some of that. And I'm thinking that especially in this last year and a half, there's been a lot of brand new stress that none of us have seen before, and brand new circumstances. Am I correct in perceiving that there's a difference there?
Absolutely. I mean, a basic human need is to avoid uncertainty. We don't like things that are unexpected. People like knowing where their next meal is coming from. They like knowing what's going to happen. And so uncertainty itself can be a demand. And especially in this pandemic setting where no one could have predicted all the changes that society underwent. But as you said, the more you do this, people now are kind of used to this. And that's about the ideas behind stress inoculation. And so rather than removing stressors, so not coming into the studio to do the show, you wouldn't feel stressed, but also there would be no show. But if you do the show over and over and over again, you get used to that. And that's kind of the idea behind a lot of school shifting models from not eliminating testing. So that'd be removing stressors from students' lives, but rather giving students more frequent, less high stakes tests and sort of get them used to this kind of evaluative pressure. And then when people do that, they can kind of what's called get good at stress and use that as fuel to sort of help them thrive.
We are talking with Jeremy Jameson, who's an associate professor of psychology at the University of Rochester. We welcome your calls as well. Feel free to call in if it's not too stressful at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. You can also tweet at me. I am at Scott Feibusch, and happy to take your questions that way as well. Tell me a little bit about this, about the Social Stress Lab. What are some of the things that you research? How long have you been doing this? And what should people know about what you do there?
Absolutely. I've been at Rochester here for about 9 years now. We moved out here. And we set up the lab then. And our research focuses mainly on stress regulation and emotion regulation. Like I said, these models, I work off of these BPS models, these biopsychosocial models. The sort of fulcrum point that's determining the form a stress response takes, whether we have this avoidance threat response or this really approach-oriented challenge response, it's rooted in appraisals. And the appraisals are my perceptions of resources versus demands. And those have direct consequences for our physiological responses. And so we get people in our lab to do things that are stressful. And so we have students come in, or we have participants come in, and they might have to give a speech about their personal strengths and weaknesses in front of two evaluators who don't look particularly pleased with the speech. As imagine, it's a very stressful experience. It's a lot of demands, and it's meant to sort of give a perception that you're not meeting those demands. And while they're doing this, we're hooking them up to impedance cardiography, electrocardiography, all these physiological measures that we're taking in people's bodies while they're performing. And so we look at sort of how does this stress manifest in the body? How do those bodily responses predict performance outcomes? And then from there, we can say, okay, how can I optimize this? How can I help this person regulate their stress responses in a more adaptive way? And a lot of the information is that people we find, they're just that stress of being stressed. They feel their heart rate increasing. They feel their palms getting sweaty. And they try to mitigate it. They try to get rid of it. But in those performance settings, this is a really important distinction, is that if you're in a goal-directed behavior setting, if you have performance to do, stress can be helpful. I mean, you have this increase in heart rate, and you have dilation in your blood vessels, you're going to get a lot more oxygen to your brain. Oxygen in your brain is a very good thing for cognitive performance. And so we can do things to help you perceive their stress response itself as a resource that's actually helping them to achieve and thrive in those situations. That can go a long way to improving the biological responses they're demonstrating.
And I do see that. I mean, when I come in here to do this show, I can feel my heart rate is up a little bit. You know, I am definitely engaged in, and I think you're right. That's a good thing because I'm paying attention to you. I'm paying attention to the show in a way that I might not be if I'm in here filling in for Beth Adams at Morning Edition, at 5:40 in the morning. There are times, I confess, I admit, I'm not always 100% awake and 100% ready to take that on that early in the morning. So I do see the value in that. Public speaking in particular. I mean, you use that as your example of how to get somebody stressed. to me, because I've been on the radio for a long time and I do this a lot, you know, that to me isn't the first thing that I would look at and say, wow, that's the thing that's going to get me stressed. But that's kind of a universal stressor for a lot of people, right?
Yeah, it's very effective at activating these stress axes in people's brains. And that's sort of what we really want, is to get their bodies engaged, get sort of this system online so we can sort of do things, help regulate it. We can do things to see if, wow, it's affecting downstream performance outcomes. We also do quite a bit of work in field settings. And so a lot of recent work I've been doing with David Yeager and Chris Bryan at the University of Texas, we just finished up a series of five different studies, like sort of double-blind field experiments, looking at this, promoting this idea that stress can be enhancing. So it's not that it always is, it can be. And you can use this stress to fuel your achievement. And what we're finding is that even in these field settings, we're going into schools, students are doing a lot better coping with their exams. They're demonstrating less internalizing symptoms in their daily lives. And so this has a really powerful effect on people.
Was this research conducted primarily pre-pandemic, or have you been doing it since things got started with the pandemic?
It was the first four studies in the sequence for pre-pandemic. And so we did a national representative sample of high school students. We examined their stress appraisals there. We had students from U of R doing this, what's called that Trier social stress test, that public speaking task, or monitoring the physiology. We had students down in Texas doing this in their classrooms. And then we had students at a charter school here in Rochester. And there's a Rochester Academy Charter School. There's a wonderful, wonderful team of people up there. And there we were looking at daily stressors in this high school environment. It just so happened that the sample that was running down in Texas was running during the spring of 2020.
Uh-huh.
And so the fifth study ended up being that sample of people and how they were coping with the stress of the pandemic. And remember, all these materials we're developing, it's about helping people optimize and change sort of their stress responses in academic settings. These are students. And so the pandemic is not an academic stressor. This is a whole different beast there. But we found that the students who went through the intervention, this was like 2 months prior, if they believed at baseline that their stress was harmful to them and was negative, during the pandemic, they showed a greater degree of internalizing symptoms, so more anxiety. The students who went through the intervention who had those prior negative beliefs didn't show that relationship. So we attenuated the anxiety that they were experiencing. So this can be really helpful for sort of helping people navigate these really acute sort of stressors in people's lives.
So talk a little bit more about that intervention. What are you doing? What are you teaching them to do for themselves?
So we call it a synergistics mindset intervention. And the synergistics part is that we help people engage with difficult situations. So if I fail at this, what does this mean to me? Does this mean that I'm a failure? Or does this mean that I can use this to grow and learn and change? It's this idea behind growth mindsets and Carol Dweck's research. And then we combine that with this idea that stress can be enhancing and it can be sort of, it can fuel you to help achieve those needed ends. So people don't innovate when they're comfortable. People innovate when they do difficult things. I mean, I love my son's school has this really wonderful motto. So the Hartley School has this cool little motto. They say, we can do hard things. And like, yeah, you can do hard things. You're going to need to do hard things in your life. And this sort of, we use this information to teach people that the response your body's having, it's helping you to achieve that end. Where this kind of intervention doesn't really work is for chronic stressors. If you are something that you can't control, maybe you live in an impoverished environment, you have to be concerned about maybe harm might occur to you, reappraising your stress as functional adaptive is not going to help you in that situation. So this is when I say like stress can be enhancing. It's the situation, the context matters quite a bit.
So what are, I mean, there have to have been more of those stressors that pop up during the pandemic. And I'm thinking just of going to trying to do education remotely. And for students, you know, especially for students who need a routine and who have gotten used to a routine and all of a sudden everything about that routine has been disrupted and they're accustomed to being in a place that they know and seeing a teacher that they know. And now they're just in front of a screen. And that can be a stressor for people too, right?
Certainly. I mean, this is something that I experience. Even trying to teach our college courses, I mean, it's a different situation than a younger child transitioning into that kind of learning, but it was really hard. It was very difficult to try to take a course that was meant to be sort of this interactional, discussion-based course. And doing that in this unfamiliar setting, and again, it's going back to uncertainty and familiarity. Familiarity is a resource for us. We can expect what's going to happen. And then having added demand, maybe if I'm home with my children too, then teaching them their work and teaching my college students their work, that's an extra demand. And so you have to sort of marshal your resources in a way that we've never had to before.
Have you done any studies yet, or is this something that you at least have some surmises about that particular trying to do it through a screen? Because, you know, again, it's weird for me. I can sit here all day in a radio studio in front of a microphone and talk to people, and I'm good. I do stand-up comedy occasionally. I can get up on a stage and talk to people doing that. I'm great with that. If I've got to sit in a room by myself in front of a laptop screen and interact with somebody over Zoom, boom, I'm off the charts stressed over that. What's up with that?
It's an unfamiliar situation for you. And that's, I think for me, when I was first doing colloquium talks and teaching over Zoom and I'm sharing my screen, I can't see me, I can't see anybody else. I was so flat because it felt like I was just talking to nobody in a room, which is the strangest experience. And I was just rambling on about my research to my own computer. And eventually you get used to it. And that sort of getting used to it, essentially, I got inoculated to that. And I sort of had to keep myself amped up. I had to keep myself activated in those settings and remind myself, like, no, you're talking with people and to people. You're not just talking to your computer.
It's a tough thing to do. We are talking with Jeremy Jameson from the University of Rochester. We're talking about stress and how it can help you. And we'd love to have you as part of the conversation, too, at 844-295-TALK. 844-295-8255. The phone number. You can find me on Twitter at Scott Feibusch. Are there different cultural meanings to stress? You know, I'm thinking about some of the conversations that I was part of on Twitter during the pandemic, especially where, you know, there's a whole culture of people saying, you know what, you can't expect to do everything. You have to let some things go and just accept that, you know, your resources in this case just aren't enough to make up for the number of stressors that are coming at you. Are there cultural markers there? Are there expectations that differ depending on where you are socially here in the U.S. or maybe in other parts of the world?
So we haven't done much cross-cultural research on the stress optimization ideas yet, but just sort of anecdotally from running a lot of studies with students and with people out in the community, we find that a lot of the East Asian cultures and sort of more interdependent cultures, the idea of a social coping resource, like other people can be resources with you. And so when you're coping with a stressor, when you're trying to address that, we seem to rely on other people. So like maybe farm out a task to somebody else. There, the pandemic disrupted that quite a bit because we isolated us from other people. And so culturally speaking, you see stressors manifest differently in different cultures, the value of stress. And so pushing yourself forward through difficult aims, that's valued differently in different cultures. So there absolutely is variation there. And I would love to study that down the road.
I'm thinking there have to have been shifts too, just in terms of, you know, if you want to lump it in as workaholism, but, you know, there has been an idea in a lot of corners of American society that there is value to pushing yourself to the limit, that there is a high value to working 50, 60, 70 hours a week in lieu of other things. And it feels like people are starting to reevaluate some of that post-pandemic and say, okay, maybe this isn't the thing that we should have been striving for. Is the stress that pushed people to do that? I mean, certainly you can point to people and say, yeah, that helped me accomplish. Was that good stress?
People need to be flexible, and that's the important thing. And so knowing when to do what. And I think that there's a time to push yourself through difficult challenges. There's also times when people objectively probably can't handle the stressors they're presented with, and they do need to come down. And so if you think about our stress response systems, I mean, think of it as a light. You can, if you have this kind of challenge or approach during the stress response, light goes on, it sends light, stressor's over, turn it off, switch goes off. These threat responses last for a while. So cortisol, its half-life is about an hour. So we don't clear it from our systems very quickly. But even if we have a lot of these challenge responses over and over again, if you keep flicking that light over and over again, eventually the bulb is going to burn out. And so this is the idea behind helping people optimize in situations where they can grow, where they can achieve and thrive, but also recognizing not to get to that burnout state, not to get to an allostatic load state that's putting a load on the body's systems too heavily.
So what happens? I mean, when you get to that state and you've been pounding yourself and there are still plenty of stressors, they don't activate you, obviously, in the same way now. What happens now?
So there's ways of either reducing the demands or increasing the resources. And so not taking on that extra assignment at work or seeking out help to maybe help educate the children if they're at home and during the pandemic. That was sort of something that we needed a lot, just people helping each other.
there were certainly points I know for me during the pandemic, there are days that I can't completely account for because there were just points where, okay, this is too much. I'm retreating for a day or two. Is it going to become, do you think, more culturally acceptable to do that?
I'm not sure. That may be something that I could see certain industries going that route. Certain other industries I could see going back to how things were in the before times, and sort of things will just go right back to normal.
I mean, it certainly plays into this whole question that we're all still answering of what is work going to look like? You know, we're at the point now here where I'm seeing more and more faces in the hallway here at WXXI that we didn't see over the last few months in the last year, but not every day. And people are still working from home, and you still never know, okay, wait, is this person in the building today? Are they somewhere else? We had an all-staff meeting yesterday where there were still a lot of people connected in remotely. If this becomes the new norm, how does this change things? What changes in stress responses when you're not in that workplace situation 40 or 50 hours a week like you might once have been?
Yeah, some people want to get back to that sort of normalcy of being in the office and going back to work in that case. And some people, the actual working from home has become, like you said, the new normal. And so now that's familiar. And so going into the office is the unfamiliar setting. And it's going to be interesting to see how people navigate the sort of joint ones. When you have some people there and some people not there. That's going to be pretty difficult, I think. And so people are going to be unexpected how to manage this sort of hybrid type model. But having people work from home, I mean, as long as their job can be fulfilled in that setting, I mean, a more familiar setting can help people achieve. I mean, maybe they work harder, maybe they work better in those situations.
Does it pop up other stresses? I mean, there are people who use the workplace as a way to get away from stress at home. Oh my God, I've got laundry that's been sitting here for a week, and now I'm sitting in a studio apartment staring at it all day and trying to do work. I can imagine that could actually add to a stress level in some cases, too.
Yeah, it's sort of compartmentalizing the different demands. Like when we're doing work, you're doing work. When you're doing housework, you're doing housework. And sort of focusing the resources in the most efficient way as possible, that's going to help when you have sort of can compartmentalize those things in a very clear way.
I feel like you should be doing this for the entire community at this point, not just for small groups of people. If people are interested, by the way, in participating in your studies, are you looking for new research subjects?
Yeah, we always have studies going on. I think on our lab website, we have a contact us button too, or I think my lab manager would love to get emails from all of us. And we have studies going on quite a bit in the community, also online studies too, just getting people's ideas about stress. And for us, it's so interesting is just these lay theories of what stress is. I just love talking with people because people never say stress it's in a good way. Like they'll say they're excited. I'm like, yeah, excitement, that's a stress state. And then it takes a little bit to click and like, oh yeah, okay, that makes sense. Like how if you want to be amped up, let's say athletes or musicians, this idea that stress can be enhancing, useful, those groups inherently just kind of get it because they're used to performing in demanding situations and then being in the sort of activated state while they're doing it.
And it's interesting that you bring in professional sports. We are both Red Sox fans. I noticed you had the hat on when you came in. Have you done research specifically on athletes and on what happens to them as they're getting ready to go in? I mean, even if it's not a big game, even if it's just, hey, it's the Red Wings playing tonight at Frontier Field, they've still got to be in a completely different kind of state as they take the field than what you or I would be in sitting there with a beer and a hot dog watching them.
Yeah, this is so we haven't done any empirical studies with the large groups of athletes, mostly because accessing those groups, getting big enough samples can be tricky. But I did do some talks with some baseball, so the Arizona Diamondbacks I was speaking with a few months ago. And it's interesting with their new players because all these players have been the best person on their teams their entire life. And then they get to the professional level and all of a sudden everybody's as good as them. And so how do you push through that and sort of keep this sort of and keep building your skills when you're now put in this completely unfamiliar setting? And a lot of it was about helping people not have this sort of avoidance-oriented threat response. So the difference between trying not to lose and trying to win is very real. Like one's approach-oriented, so trying to achieve positive outcomes. One's very avoidance-oriented, trying to avoid these negative outcomes. So trying not to screw up.
That's fascinating. So these players, I mean, they've worked their way up through college ball and through the minors, and they're accustomed to the mechanics of getting into the locker room and warming up and getting taped up and everything. But you're saying it's still a very different thing for them in the major league environment.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, let's say a batter has been in a slump and they haven't had a few hits in a while. And they might be worrying about, okay, am I executing each component of my swing properly? And they'll start paying attention to that. So trying not to do it poorly. And what that does is it breaks down the proceduralization of their swing. And so they actually perform worse by trying not to perform worse. And if you get people in these more challenged states and they're approach-oriented, it's associated with a big uptick in catecholamines. So things like epinephrine, norepinephrine, so adrenaline, colloquially. And then those are really positive predictors of performance outcomes. There's a famous research back in the 80s by Dean Spear and colleagues. And it's on physiological toughness, he called it. And this idea about catecholamines predicting positive performance outcomes linearly. So as catecholamines go up, performance went up in these cognitive tasks. And they actually never found the inverse side of the U-curve. And so it was violating what we call the Xerxes-Dodson law, that arousal is good for performance up to a point. They were saying, well, we don't know what the point is. It actually seems to be keep pushing performance in positive ways. So getting the athletes, I was talking to these baseball players about being in these states. And a lot of times in sports, you hear it called flow. But it's this activation state. It's approach-oriented. And what your body's doing is helping you sort of take on the demands in your environment, not shy away from them.
And yet you have players, and I'll go ahead and make a Red Sox comparison here. You know, David Ortiz taking the plate in some of those critical ALCS games in 04 when absolutely everything was on the line with one swing, he sure didn't look stressed.
No, I mean, I'm sure his heart was beating though pretty fast. I'm sure he had plenty of stress hormones going through his body. And you can think about, I think the best example of an athlete I've seen that doesn't look stressed, like Tim Duncan. He just looked, he would always look so calm and looked like, but he was probably in an activated state when he was performing on those games. And so this is what we find in our research. Allison Brooks, too, she's at Harvard Business School. They were comparing people who were in these excited states, so the sort of approach-oriented positive stress states, versus people who were calm. The people who were stressed outperformed the people who were calm.
It is Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch in for Evan Dawson. We are talking with Jeremy Jameson from the University of Rochester's Social Stress Lab. A lot more conversation ahead. And you, too, at 844-295-TALK. We will be back right after this quick break. In our next hour, change in society usually happens slowly, but not in the case of same-sex marriage. What was unheard of anywhere in the world in 1990 was legal all across the United States just 25 years later. How did that shift occur? Author Sasha Eisenberg talked to advocates and opponents for his new book, The Engagement. He'll join us for Summer Book Week coming up next on Connections. Stay with us. We are back on Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch. In for Evan Dawson, an hour about stress and why stress is not necessarily a bad thing. We are taking your calls as well at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. You can tweet me at Scott Feibusch. Let's go to the phones here. Terry from Rochester, you are on Connections with Jeremy Jameson.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was just wondering if you've done any longer-term studies or what I'm wondering about is how chronic stress in early childhood affects how the adult, say in late teens and early 20s, deals with stressors in their personal lives, maybe their work lives. Is the chronic stress in childhood make it harder for them?
Oh, yeah, that's a great question. I personally have not done a lot of research with younger children. Our work has been done primarily with adolescents, though, and we do see how this kinds of helping people perform better in high-stakes situations, and also how they understand that when they fail, the stress associated with that, that it's not indicative of their ability as a person, but rather it's a growth opportunity. Those tend to predict less internalizing symptoms, so it delays the onset of depression in adolescents. But in our department, Patrick Davies and Melissa Sturge Apple have a lot of really wonderful research looking at early childhood adversity. And so I would suggest sort of diving into there. But we're hopeful that these kinds of models, these kinds of interventions that are helping to teach people that the positive benefits of stress, they can accumulate and create positive outcomes downstream. And so part of that happens through which acute stress can become chronic stress. So like anxiety can predict depression a lot of times.
Yeah. All right, Terry, thanks for the call. Appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Thanks for calling in. We have another another caller off air who asked the question, how cortisol impacts stress response, and if that's something that that you're working with. I think you kind of began addressing that a little bit.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, cortisol, yeah. It's the end product of what we call the HPA axis, so the hypothalamus-pituitary-adrenal axis. It's one of our primary stress systems, especially comes online when we're threatened, this sort of negative avoidance-oriented type stress response. And cortisol is the end product of it. We're producing this from our adrenal glands. It's a stress hormone. It is catabolic. It does a lot of things. It's one of the things, it's anti-inflammatory, it suppresses immune functioning. This is sort of the consequence of being threatened is we have high cortisol levels. And so that's part of that, actually how we measure people's stress responses and their hormones is by looking at cortisol. But also look at cortisol in addition to things like DHEA, which is an anabolic hormone. It's sort of the anabolic equivalent of cortisol. It's a building up hormone. It's the kind of things that if an athlete was taking this, they wouldn't be able to play because they'd be banned for a while. But we look at a lot of the ratio of cortisol to DHEA. And that's something we call anabolic balance. And so it's really important understanding the form of the stress response because you'll see some small elevations in cortisol even when people are challenged and in these positive states. But it's offset by the strong anabolic response that protects against the catabolic breakdown of cortisol.
What about other things that people put in their bodies? I just realized I'm sitting here downing a 20-ounce bottle of highly caffeinated soda as we're talking. Rob across the board just held up his coffee cup. I'm one of those weird people in years and years of doing morning radio. I've never been a coffee drinker. My wife thinks that's absolutely bizarre. She's probably right about that. What are some of the things that caffeine can do, that alcohol can do, cannabis now that it's becoming legal, that people are looking at it for stress relief? How do these interact with that physiological response?
Yeah, things like alcohol and marijuana use, those seem to be more about trying to downregulate a negative stress response. It's actually a coping behavior a lot of times. People will drink or they will smoke when they want to sort of come down from that. Things like caffeine and things like catecholamines, you can give those people directly, and you're going to boost that sympathetic arousal just from doing that. And there's also a whole class of research on beta blockers. So people blocking the physiological effects of stress. So it actually blocks the binding of cortisol to beta-2 receptors. And there was, I was talking with students at the Eastman School, the music school here in Rochester, and these are some of the best musicians in the world. And when their exams, they're playing music in front of their teachers and their professors. And so they were trying not to have this sort of threat response. And by taking the beta blocker, they thought they were blocking that stress response. They still had all the negative cognitions that go along with stress, all this anxiety, all the avoidance motivation, but they just blocked the physiological response. And they were saying that some of the feedback they were getting when they did this is their music sounded flat. They weren't activated enough, but they still had all these negative cognitions going through their minds about the stressful situation that they were in.
Fascinating. We are talking with Jeremy Jameson, Associate Professor of Psychology at the University of Rochester. He is the Principal Investigator at the Social Stress Lab. And we are on Connections. I'm Scott Feibusch, filling in for Evan Dawson. One thing I've talked about a couple of times this week, we did a whole show about it on Monday, is comedy. And I've found one of the things that I've gotten into in the last few years, as I mentioned, is doing open mic stand-up comedy. And there are people, you know, as you've studied, who get very nervous getting up doing public speaking. I feel all the same things that you're talking about with the heart rate going up and feeling more engaged and not coming down again right away. But I don't necessarily feel stressed going up there and doing it. What is the difference there? And I know I'm not alone in doing that. I know there are people who get terrified going up and doing that and push through it. What's the difference there?
Well, I'm one of those people who gets terrified. So even like still, I give talks quite frequently, but every time I do it, it's very hard for me to get in front of people and do these things. So when you're up there, I'm sure you're activated. I'm sure you're sort of in this high arousal state. When you said you don't feel stressed, it's because, well, how are you labeling stress? You might be excited. It might be sort of invigorating. We don't use the word stress for any positive situations. That's one of the tricks. And so if anyone takes away one thing from this today, is that stress isn't always bad. It can be functional. It can be adaptive, help you grow and achieve. Like a lot of things that we study when people are in these high stakes performance situations, like maybe in a job interview or they're being evaluated up on stage doing a comedy show, their body's response is helpful because there is a demand and that stress will offset, it will go away. It's not this chronic type stress response we have.
So you're saying when I'm up there, I am stressed. I should identify that as stress, but it's stress that I'm enjoying that's pushing me, hopefully, to do a better job and be funnier and engage better with an audience.
Yes. So you would not benefit from our interventions or our manipulations because you're already doing what we're trying to tell people, is that you want to get in this activated state. You want to be in this approach-oriented state. And so the idea is that people who get really nervous and like do all these things to try to calm down. And that can be hard because what you're doing is by engaging efforts to sort of lower your stress levels, you're lumping on more demands to yourself. You're saying, I need to do X, Y, and Z, or you're paying attention to your body's responses rather than paying attention to other aspects of the environment that might help you succeed. And so that can be tricky. Stress reduction techniques can work really well in terms of settling people in more kind of chronic ways, so doing like meditation practices. But when you're in those situations where you do need to perform and you need to achieve, the stress responses can be much more helpful than getting rid of them.
You know, physiologically, you're spot on. I get home at 10 o'clock from having done a 5-minute set, and I can't fall asleep until 1 in the morning because you're saying that's all still going on in my body physiologically.
Yeah, so we're still in this activated state. When we're challenged, we're positively kind of stressed, that tends to offset, it kind of you back to homeostasis pretty quickly, actually. So like I talked about DHEA, it's anabolic hormone. We clear DHEA in like a few minutes. We don't clear cortisol for like an hour. So even an hour, let's say we're really threatened, really anxious and nervous, an hour after I gave that public speech when I was really nervous, I'm still having a stress response in my body. And so we talked about the understanding how something that's acute can sort of accumulate to chronic processes, to chronic stress. That's one way which happens.
And if I've also had a beer just before going up on stage?
I'm not sure that's going to interact with your stress systems all that much. It might actually help you embrace things in different ways. But the alcohol is not going to interact with the HPA systems a ton.
Fascinating. I've gotten my personal stress advice today. Let's go back to the phones. Carol from Brighton, you are next on Connections with Jeremy Jameson. Welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. Ironically, I'm having a bit of stress because Jerry talks quite rapidly, more rapidly than I'm used to with the other people that I hear on the radio. Although I have noticed in recent years that, or maybe the last 2 years, that I think people on the radio, announcers and so forth, are starting to speak a little faster, and it kind of bugs me. But what he's saying, I'm sure, is very interesting, but it's kind of hard for me to process it when he's speaking so fast. I just want to say, please slow down.
And I'm guessing I'm guessing this is a kind of stress that's not helpful to you right now, right?
No, this is right. Something I get that feedback all the time, so I apologize. I will try to go far more slowly.
Okay.
All right, Carol, thanks for the call.
It's a very interesting topic. Thank you.
Thanks so much.
Bye.
844-295-TALK, 844, I'll say it slowly, 295-8255 is the number. It is Connections. We're talking with Jeremy Jameson. I want to get back to one point that had come up, I think, just before the break, where we were talking about kids in school and about what the effects are later on in life of having gone through stress early on. And you know, again, just watching my kids, watching other people's kids during the course of this last year and a half. On the one hand, they've certainly been stressed in a lot of ways that were completely novel compared to kids even a few years before them in school. Is some of that, or some of the adaptations that they've had to learn to get through the pandemic year and to learn these different styles of learning and how to work with them, to what extent do you think that's going to be beneficial for them later, or are there going to be some long-term lasting negative effects from this?
It can kind of depend on how they're orienting themselves to those stressors. And a lot of it can, in the adolescence and childhood, it's times of a lot of change. And so this uncertainty, these big life transitions going from high school, like middle school to high school, for instance, kids are really attuned, especially adolescents are attuned to the sort of social feedback and social hierarchies. And now in modern society, there's so many different ways of getting that feedback, not just face-to-face now. Now we have social media. And we've done studies actually manipulating feedback on social media where we created a platform and students were writing blurbs about themselves. And they got either a lot of likes on their posts or they got kind of no likes on their posts. And they're kind of low down in this little ranking system. the students, these high school students, they reported less, they'd be more lonely, more distress, being sort of more negative about their emotions, just from the simple online program that's not, I mean, it's not a real social media program. We just did this for the study. And downstream, even 2 months later, the people who were rejecting the social media paradigm were showing more internalizing symptoms. And that was something that we didn't expect. And so we were saying that this can have sort of long-term effects. So we went back in with that sample and have since done some intervention studies with those same kids. But yeah, social media is a whole nother way of creating stress in kids, especially these evaluative pressures that they're facing constantly.
I would say not just kids, but adults too. I took myself off of Facebook at one point last fall and have kind of tried to stay off of it. And I've gotten just as addicted to Twitter on the other end. So I don't know that it actually balanced out any better, but there certainly, at least for me, is, you know, I'll be up before I go to bed tonight. Oh, did anybody like that tweet I just posted? Why aren't these people I follow following me back? There's got to be something real to that that's new to our generation too.
Oh yeah, I mean, evaluative pressures we're facing online, it's just like the same evaluative pressures we faced face to face before this. And so people think that the online environment's watering down the meaning of what that evaluation is. It's not. And so when a high school student is maybe cyberbullying another student, that's just as bad as like a face to face bullying situation. But the computer gives you a degree of anonymity. And so the whole concept of trolling is this. People will say things on a computer they will not say to somebody's face. But that kind of feedback can produce a demand in the person that you're targeting in a very real way.
Fascinating. Jeremy Jameson is our guest from the University of Rochester on Connections. Another caller with a question here that she sent in. Meredith from Webster says she's a new mom. She has read about the neurons between mothers and babies. She wants to know, Jeremy, if you can speak to how the stress response impacts new babies. How as a mother can she reduce that kind of response? Is that something, you know, there's plenty of stuff certainly for new parents to worry about. How much more stress should she worry about there?
Yeah, there's a lot of demands with new parents, and so lack of sleep, lots of cortisol floating around. But there is some fascinating research by Sarah Waters and Wendy Mendez that looks at something called physiological linkage between moms and babies. And so in their studies, they brought new mothers into the lab, and they had the moms do that speech task. They had them do that sort of negative evaluative task while the babies played in a different room. They brought the baby back into the mom, and the baby started linking with the mom's stress response when they had this negative response. When the moms didn't do the speech task, when they were doing something different, the babies didn't link to the mom's physiology. So the babies knew, essentially, mom is experiencing stress. I need to then be aware of what's going on. I need to link up with this other organism that's protecting me because something might be wrong in my environment.
And they're just picking up signs.
It seems
from
to be by
the parents
touch.
Somehow? By okay.
Yeah, so that seems how it was communicated in this particular study. But there's this idea if we linked people physiologically if we know that we might need to. And so mom and babies do that sort of intuitively, like from a very young age. These were six-month-old babies.
Are there more general differences? I've noticed that all of our callers so far today have been women. Are there differences physiologically as opposed to just all the different cultural stressors that affect women that you can point to that would make them more susceptible to some of the bad forms of stress or less able to benefit from the good forms?
We don't find any gender differences in the effectiveness of some of these intervention or regulation techniques. I mean, speaking anecdotally, culturally wise, it's more probably acceptable to say that I'm overwhelmed or I need help if you're the female gender norms. But yeah, we don't really typically see that. Where you will see differences emerge are in HPG axes, so hypothalamic pituitary gonadal axis. And so we're looking at something about threats to, let's say, a conspecific, so a threat to your child. A mom's response to oxytocin hormones, that can produce sort of aggression towards whatever's causing your child harm. Men will have higher levels of testosterone. So testosterone is a very approach-oriented hormone, and so it helps people sort of take on sort of challenges in our environments. And so you do see some differences in those kinds of responses based on the different stress axes we see with men and women, but not in the effectiveness of some of these regulation techniques.
So you bring up testosterone, you bring up men, and that kind of brings to mind for me some of the things that we've seen, you know, as a larger community, some of the policing responses that we've seen. Have you looked at all, or are you thinking of doing research at all on some of the ways in which stress affects law enforcement responses and creates perhaps some of these situations that have been so damaging to the community?
Yeah, I mean, you have to remember that when a police officer is going into a situation that they're called to, they're approaching a dangerous situation, and so they are going to have a strong stress response. There was some work out of, again, Wendy Mendez's lab that was showing, looking at cortisol levels, how it's modifying just decisions on these, we call like a shooter task. It's like a first-person shooter type game. And what it was doing was reducing misses. So police officers were not missing when people had, when they maybe they're having a gun or they're holding just a regular object. They weren't missing the guns. They were getting really accurate at finding them, but also it led to slightly more false alarms in some cases too, especially when the target with certain kinds of racial identities.
Interesting. We're talking with Jeremy Jameson from the University of Rochester. A last chance for you to get in with a phone call. There's still a few minutes left at 844-295-TALK, 844-295-8255. Let's get back to sort of what people can do on a practical level if they're not actually participating in one of your studies and learning directly from you. What sort of advice do you give? Can you give generally if people are listening and say, okay, I want to, you know, I get this idea that maybe in some cases stress can be good for me. How do you train yourself to learn from that and to be able to make it work in your favor? What are some exercises people could do?
Yeah, so when there's times if you're in high performance situations and you notice your heart racing, you notice your palms are sweating, you notice you butterflies in your stomach, reminding yourself that that is helping me to achieve. That's not hurting me. That's not holding me back. I don't need to get rid of it. I can lean into this. And so a lot of growth and a lot of innovation happens because of stress, not in spite of stress. And just even the idea that your stress response can be helpful, that can produce a big change.
So how do you get there? What can people do if they're listening and say, okay, I get this intellectually, I understand that this could be good for me, but I'm running around with 19 different things on my to-do list today and I'm already late for a doctor's appointment, my kids need to be picked up later, and how do I process this in a real world way?
Yeah, it's hard because when we do this in lab studies, we're basically having people do these interventions or teaching them all these things, and then they're writing about how it can help them, and then they're going off and immediately doing a stressful task so they can practice it right away. And in the school settings, we were doing it before exams, so people can practice this right away. The interesting thing I think about the work I'm doing with Dave Yeager and Chris Bryan is that we're helping people to engage with stress. We're trying to teach them to take on that hard thing. Don't shy away from it. And so that's the first part is the engagement piece. So engage with that stressor initially. And if I engage with it, okay, my body's response is there to help me to achieve. And so that's the main thing. Try to find a context, try to find a situation where you can practice this.
And there is that feeling. I mean, I know, you know, I was referring to some points last fall where I just couldn't get anything done. And then all of a sudden, one morning I get up like, okay, I have these three things. If I can get through these, I'm going to feel so much better. And I did. Once I got them off the list, I was like, okay, that wasn't so hard. I got that done. I used that response to push me through it. Now I'm done. Should people reward themselves too? Is it helpful to say, okay, I did that. Now I can go out and have an ice cream. Now I can go out and take a walk or a bike ride.
Yeah, that's a good point because you're basically clearing off the demand. You've addressed it. It's over. It's okay to go back down to homeostasis. It's okay to get relaxed again. And that's when the stress offsets. We don't need the stress response. In the talk in this whole, when I talk about people about how stress can be helpful, it's helpful when we need it. When we don't need it, it's not helpful. And so what you want to be is you actually want to be in that low activation state unless you're doing something that requires marshaling resources to address those demands.
At which point, all of a sudden, you do. Are there people, I mean, the term neurotypical probably is an overgeneralization, but you know, I know people in my life who have suffered from pretty intense overall anxiety. Is it different for those kinds of people in the way that they process this? Can they benefit from this in the same ways? And how would you address it with them?
Yeah, we've done a few studies with people with social anxiety disorder is the primary group I've studied. And they do benefit from these stress regulation techniques, but they're starting at a point of much more distress. And so you can lessen it, but you're not getting someone back fully to like functioning in a normal way. And so it can work. The tricky thing about anxiety especially is that a lot of times anxiety will predict depression. And so then people will ruminate about the stress. They think about what happened to them. And so you talked about rewarding yourself, going out for an ice cream. You're not going to be ruminating on what you just did. You're sort of, you've already done that. It's over. And eliminating that rumination component and that sort of stress about being stressed or being anxious about something chronically, that's really challenging. And so I am not a clinical psychologist.
That's where you got to defer to that community.
Yes, and absolutely.
And to other forms of treatment. In terms of being able to kind of gauge this on a day-to-day basis, you know, so many more of us are wearing fitness trackers and smartwatches. Is knowing what your heart rate is in a much more detailed way, is that helpful to this, or can that sometimes drive you crazy?
I think it depends on who you are. If you're constantly checking it, or how many steps you took, or what your heart rate is, you're essentially added something that's now a demand to you. You now are paying attention to that thing all the time. But it gives you insights into what's going on in your body that can be really helpful. If you find that you have a very strong stress response every time you go to, let's say, a certain place, probably you go to the dentist, maybe you can do things about understanding what your stress is doing in that situation and help you maybe avoid things that are causing some undue stress. And so it can give important information in that regard. But just simple heart rate, it can't differentiate this kinds of negative avoidance stress from the sort of positive approach kind of stress. It's just general sympathetic arousal.
All right, Jeremy Jamieson, we are out of time. Hopefully this was not too stressful for you.
No, this is fun.
All right, thank you so much for being my guest on Connections from the University of Rochester. I'm Scott Feibusch, in for Evan Dawson, with Emma Ray Stein at the producer's desk, Rob Braden behind the glass, and the award-winning Employee of the Year, Megan Mack, is our executive producer. We're back next hour with more book